Hi, I'm Marissa, and I'm codependent if you'd like me to be. And I'm still codependent for those who already heard that yesterday. It is my supreme pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight. First of all, I'd like to see, by raise of hands, how many of you have been helped by the writing of our speaker, Melody B. Melody, can you look? Okay. Just a couple. You noticed she raised her own hand as well. Codependent No More came out in 1986. 8 million copies worldwide. Translated in many, many languages. I heard during this conference that it's used in many of her, one of her 18 books that she's published since has helped in meetings. Some people use them actually as text in meetings. So that is such a blessing. And her work, I am really, really grateful to call her also my friend and my gratitude partner. And I get to do gratitude lists with her on a daily basis. And she truly is someone who is a source. The Spirit guides her in her words to help us all. She is a great example of unconditional love to myself and also to my daughters. For me, her work puts the map. It's a map to help us travelers get out of our dysfunctional one-way streets and to find a terrain of love and joy and peace and precious and freedom from our codependency. She knows pain firsthand, abandonment, kidnapping, sexual abuse, addiction, divorce, and the death of her son, Shane, who was 12. And that is, her heart, and that's what comes out. So when she says, I feel your pain, she really does feel your pain. And without anything further, I'd like to bring up our speaker, our beloved Melody B.
Thank you, Marissa. I didn't think I was supposed to say I feel your pain anymore. Hi, my name is Melody, and I'm a member of many 12-step groups, and Codependence Anonymous is one of them. You know, I've got a lot of things I want to say. One is I'm really happy to see that people are into service. I mean, we went through such a long period where people would say, well, I can't be of service. I can't do any giving. I'm in recovery. And there's a circle we need to travel, and we need to go all the way back to the beginning. And until we do, we're not there yet. And that means, you know, the freedom to love and the freedom to give. The freedom to be able to say the words, I'm in love, or I love. Those are all good words to be able to say, and they're good things to be able to do. And I feel, you know, I didn't know how numb our whole world had gotten until my high school, and probably like many of you, my high school years were just horrible. And there were no Kodak moments. And we tend to not keep pictures of times that are really painful or were really bad. And so there were no pictures of my high school years, I thought. But the principal was so happy because he had dug out one. And I got in there and I got on stage and then I looked behind, and behind me on the screen, bigger than life, was the one picture that existed of me during probably the most painful part of my life. And I look back at it, and it started a family of origin healing process like I had never been in before, but luckily I had spoken enough times where I could kind of keep it together enough to get through the talk. And then for the next 5 months, I went through a pain so heavy and so severe. And I thought, you know, the result of it was that I finally forgave myself for being an addict. Because I thought, I can barely handle these feelings now. If I felt that way as a child, it's a miracle that I'm still alive, that I didn't kill myself. And so for those of you that are what they so fondly refer to as double winners, and are still being a little bit hard on yourselves, I think it's okay for us to stop doing that and to love ourselves and realize that each step of the way we have done the best that we could, even when our best wasn't very good. You know, it was what we could do. Before I came tonight, a little backstory about, 5 years ago, I had two discs that were totally gone, and my choice was being in bed or a wheelchair the rest of my life, or going to Germany and being cut open like a deer and having two new discs pounded in my back. And so I went to Germany and I went that route. So tonight when I was getting ready to come, I thought, well, I'm getting dressed up, I should probably wear heels. And I thought, well, I haven't done that in 5 years. And part of me is saying, well, look, what will people think? So I'm wearing my tennis shoes. And it is a long process. You know, I hear people talking all the time and they say, well, you know, I've been in the program for 4 months now. And I'm self-controlling. And you know, controlling's not all bad either. I mean, all of the behaviors we do are survival behaviors, and they're normal. They're normal human responses and behaviors. It's normal to want to feel a sense of control. That's not something bizarre or unusual. We tend to cross a line with it and get a little bit deep with it, but there's a reason. You know, if you would have asked me 20 years ago how much of codependency is grief, what part do you think grief plays in it? I would have said 10%. And now, if you ask me, I would say, oh, 98%. And when we're losing things, whether that's a love we've never known, a parent's love we've never known, somebody that's not available to us, not knowing how to love, not just anything. I mean, I came up with a list of losses, and I think I came up with over 400 things we can lose as we go through life. And although Elizabeth Kubler-Ross did some wonderful work on the stages of grief, she did leave out some stages, and one of them is obsession. It's very normal to obsess about what we lose. It's very normal to try and control our losses, you know, get a handle on them. And guilt. Because believe it or not, guilt is a survival behavior too. And so is low self-esteem. Because if we caused it, if we made it happen, and if it's our fault, at least then it gives us a feeling of control. It's not just a random event that happened in a random world where some monster is up there throwing mud balls at us. You know, we did it. We made the bad thing happen, and there's something wrong with us. And even that is a survival behavior defense mechanism. It doesn't mean that we want to stay in that place all our life, but I think we can lighten up on ourselves for the ways we thought and the behaviors we chose and the things that we did, because there was a reason. There's a reason for everything that happens. It's both a spiritual saying and it's a very cause and effect saying. There is a very sound reason for everything that we end up doing. We get to a point, though, when the reason doesn't matter as much as learning how not to do it anymore. Now, did someone say that the theme is the Yellow Brick Road? I mean, truly, if you there is no wizard, and if somebody claims to be, you know, pull the curtain on the behind. But there is magic in this program, and I want to talk about that magic tonight. I ran into a friend, long-term friend, known this person for 30-some years, a couple days ago, and I kept on her. I said, what are you doing? What are you doing? That's different. I said, you look beautiful, but I said, you've always looked beautiful, but this is different. This is like from the inside out. You've got this glow, and it's like your heart is, I don't know. I said, there's something so different about you, and it's so incredibly beautiful. What have you done? And she said, well, I don't know. What do you think it is? I said, I don't know. What are you doing different? And she's been going to 12-step programs, another double winner, for probably 10 years. And she said, well, one thing is I've recently started to work the steps. And she said, I've surrendered. I said, so step three? She said, yeah. She said, I've begun to make amends. I said, wow. I said, well, I think that that's probably it. We can survive if we miss a meeting. We can survive if we don't have time to go out for dinner with our friends after a meeting. There's a lot of things we can get by without. But I don't know how anybody can get by without the steps. They're a gift, and they're the heart of this program. And you know, I like to say there's two ways to use them. We do them the big, hard way, probably a couple times, but really we only need to do them. It's like a tunnel. We only need to go through that tunnel once. But then there's also a little way we can use them, where they're like tools that have been given to us, and we carry them around in our pocket. And whenever we run into a problem, I don't care what problem it is. Any problem at all, the steps fit. One of them will work to help us solve that problem. We can apply it to it. It won't necessarily make the problem go away, but it will help us to change. They're like a ladder out of the darkness and into the light. And so that's what I wanted to talk about tonight, was my experience with these steps. I was so angry the first time I walked into a meeting and somebody came up to me and started saying, oh, and it wasn't, there weren't any Codependence Anonymous meetings in the area I lived in then, so it was an Al-Anon meeting. So for all purposes, I'm going to compare the two because they are kind of sister programs in a way, or cousin programs. She said, oh, you're an Al-Anon. I said, no, I'm an addict. She said, oh, you're a double winner. And I was so livid. I mean, I was furious because I didn't feel like I had won anything. All I could see was what I had lost. I had lost another family. Yeah, all I could see was what I had lost. And I mean, my whole life has felt like I've tried to have a family, and it's slipped through my fingers like sand my whole life. The harder I try and have a family, the more it just disappears. I marry a man who's supposed to be the premier counselor in the state of Minnesota, and it turns out that he never got sober. He's been sneak drinking the whole time. And so I stay in the marriage as long as I can because I'm so filled with guilt. And then I tell the kids, okay, we're going to still be a family. Okay, the three of us are going to make it. And then a couple years later, my son dies. And so I look at my daughter and I try and convince her that we're still going to be a family, but I don't sound very convincing because I don't even believe my own words. It's just been real hard to find a blood family. Now, to find a group of people that I belong to. And actually, the blood family, did you know that they've done work scientifically that's proven that we each have DNA in us from every race in the world? And that saying that we're one with everything and everyone is more than just, you know, some woo-woo stuff. It's fact. And then there's a line that says, forgive others as we forgive ourselves is more than a suggestion. Because if you look at the idea that there is a piece of everyone, including and especially those along our family hierarchy in ourselves, if we're still hating on someone in our family, then we're hating ourselves. And there's no way we can become free. Absolutely no way. It's impossible genetically to do that. There's another saying that says you have to love yourself before you can love others. And I do take a little bit of, I challenge that statement a little bit. Because for some of us, we have no idea what love looks or feels like. We do not have the remotest idea of what it means to love or to be loved. We've tried our own tactics, you know, reaching out and grabbing and clutching and taking hostage and being needy and hoping we'll finally have self-esteem. You know, oh, I've got a ring on my finger, I'm married, I'm somebody. And wanting. Love isn't about wanting. Love isn't about wanting. And it's not about needing. It's about being present for, being fully there for, and unconditional love. You use those words up here when you introduced me. And it's very hard. It's very hard to love anyone unconditionally, including ourselves. That's a pretty, pretty big calling to say that we're not going to judge. Pretty hard to get there. It's also pretty hard to judge because the minute I do, I find myself doing the very thing I judge someone for. And so I like to do that. Oh, I take that back, universe. Please, didn't hear that. Right after my surgery 5 years ago, I got a phone call. And I didn't get a phone call. I'm sorry. I got one of those calls that we get, and I knew I had to go see my mother. I had been up to see her about 3 years before the surgery, and she was getting ripped off terribly by a granddaughter. I mean, she was just getting stolen blind. She had hired the granddaughter had removed her, my mother, from all her friends, removed her from all her sources of support, taken her to a remote community, and was in control of her life and in her pocketbook and not doing what she was supposed to be doing. And I went up there to check on my mother then, and my mother was always just this horrendous wench. Oh, she was a horrible woman. And I had had her out to my house a few years before that, and she kept doing this, where am I, how'd I get here, when am I going home? And so I drew this great big calendar, And she still kept saying, well, you know, I'm losing my memory. I can't remember things. Where am I? When am I going home? And I thought, what did I do? Because it was one of those illusionary ideas I had that I could bring her out. And I'd been in this program long enough that I could be with my mother for 2 weeks. And we could experience love and have a really good time. And I wouldn't get hooked. And I wouldn't feel guilty. And I wouldn't feel angry. And it took about 5 minutes for that illusion to get smashed. And then I kept thinking, 2 weeks, 2 weeks of this. I can't, you know, a friend came by, I'll give you $5,000 if you take care of it. It's a cash. And I was serious. And then something occurred to me. I thought, you know, if she can't remember how long she's supposed to be here, I'll just go. And I called the airport, and I was able to change her reservations. And so I changed the calendar. So the next time she said, well, you know, when, where am I? When am I going home? I said, here's your calendar, Mom. And all of a sudden she went, what do you mean 5 days? I'm supposed to be here 2 weeks. And so, I mean, this was a mother I had grown to know and run away from. But now things had, you know, had changed. And when I went up to where she lived, she was unable to get out of bed. I had never seen my mom unable to get out of bed to try and control whatever was going on. Something was definitely wrong, but she didn't want my help. I had her taken to the hospital. The doctor declared her competent. I went to every agency in town. It was a small town, but I hit them all, vulnerable adult, family services, even the police department. I heard the same thing from everyone. There's nothing you can do. And a little part of me went tick, 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 tick. I am powerless over this situation. And my life will shortly become unmanageable if I try and do what's impossible. My mother did not want my help. She said, get the hell out of here. Leave me alone. And she had signed everything over to this granddaughter. And the granddaughter was not taking care of her. So I just left. And I thought, well, that was a waste of money and time. And then a little voice went, no, nothing is a waste in our world. Now, there was a time when no way would I have been able to work that first step in one day. I would have banged my head on walls and cement. I would have driven myself nuts. I would have driven everyone up there nuts. And I still would have ended up with the same result. It's practice. It's a practice. Working these steps is a practice. And the more we work them, the easier it is to work them and to know when they apply. It's like, I don't know how many people here work out, but it's almost like we build up muscle memory. And the more we work these steps, the easier it is to do them the next time. And so how do we get good at them? It helps to write them out and do workbooks, but the real way we get good at them is by practicing them in our lives. And believe me, we will get all the opportunities. And our lessons, it's taken me a long time to understand that it is not, they're not random lessons. There's a very kind of thoughtful process going on. It is, in fact, a benevolent universe, even though it most or some of the time appears otherwise. And there is a reason things happen, and it's a loving reason in the end. It takes a while to get to the end. But after my surgery, all right, I had to go to bed for 6 months, and I got this call and something went, you need to go see your mother now. And so as soon as the doctor allowed me to travel, I flew to Minnesota, and I called up my sister and said, I'm picking you up at 10 o'clock, we're going to go see Mom. And we knocked on the door, and this woman that we didn't recognize answered it. And then we just stared at each other. This woman had hair halfway down her back. She hadn't had a bath in probably 3 or 4 months. Her sheets were stiff. The carpeting squished with cat urine. She was getting fed at most 5 meals a week. And I went, there is something I can do now. There is something I can do. And up till that point, my relationship with her had been based on duty and decision. What do I want to do? What am I willing to do? What am I willing to take responsibility for? And to me, that was working step two, believing that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity in my behavior with people generally. What am I willing to do? Because if I make a conscious choice, then it's impossible, even though I might try and find a tech, it's impossible for me to be a victim. Because I've chosen to do that particular thing. And then we get to the third step, surrendering. And it's, you know, all I can say about that step is it's one of those things in life that hurts more before we do it. Because as soon as we do it, the pain goes away. And if it doesn't go away, it at least neutralizes. So I began a process, and what I had done, I considered myself a dutiful daughter. And I would do what I felt was my duty as a good daughter. And I was comfortable with that. And I decided I was going to do something a little bit different. Or it happened to me. You know, I've never found the steps. The steps have found me. I've never found my lessons. My lessons have found me. All I have to do is be open and show up. And if I don't show up, it kicks me. Life kicks me out of bed, you know. I mean, there's just not all that much to, you know, we talk about free will. We get to choose what we're going to have for breakfast. But once we've surrendered, there is a path laid out for us. There is a path. And I made a decision. I looked at my mom's life and I thought, you know, my mom, she'd been married 8 to 10 times. Nobody in the family was sure. She had been running around looking for love her entire lifetime. And she was totally unable to give it to her children, to any of them. And she wrote her memoirs, volumes 1, 2, 3, 4, called My Life. And it was a desperate, codependent seeking and wanting for love. And so I made a decision. I thought, you know what? Before she passes, I want her to feel loved. I want her to feel unconditionally loved and to have that experience. That's one thing I can give her, and I'm willing to do that for her. Not duty, because duty is a whole different thing. You know, duty is cleaning the bathroom. And so I set out to do this, and I was lucky, because a lot of people, when they get Alzheimer's, they get mean. And my mother died at night. She forgot how much she hated everyone. And for the first time during this, I went through 3 years of flying back there once or twice a month, every month. And the judge made me conservator, which made everyone in the family hate me, except my brother. And I was co-guardian with a sister who, you know, really helped me until the judge made me sole conservator. At which point she said, you get to have all the fun. But it's a hard time in families. I don't know if any of you have been through that, the role reversal when it's time for the children to take care of the parent. I mean, a lot of us started our lives out that way. But then we find ourselves legitimately being in that position later on in life. And it was a real time for me of needing to work the steps. But I was able to bring all the riches, all the gold this program has brought me was able to bring them in and use them, and it was very much divinely ordained, I believe. I mean, if I would cry, you know, she could still be a wench, and she could still, I had a male caretaker, one of the caretakers was male, and, you know, very macho kind of a guy. She could bring him to tears. But she also had her very loving moments, and I remember one time I had started to cry because she'd been screaming at me all morning. And she suddenly changed, and she put her arm around me, and she said, "What's the matter, honey? Can I help you? Can I make it better?" And I thought, you know, that's the first time in my whole life she's ever nurtured me or spoken those words to me. But when she died, she looked younger than my sisters. She looked beautiful. I mean, she glowed. It wasn't the work in the steps in her case, but I believe it was from the experience of being loved. And some of us, the point of that whole story is some of us don't know what it feels like to be loved. Sometimes I try and imagine what it would have felt like to be a child and to have been loved then. How would that have changed me? How would that change me? And I can't conjure it. I can't imagine it. I can't bring it to be a reality, to imagine what it feels like to be loved as a child. I just can't get there. But I can now. And when I got sober, when the judge told me that I could choose to go to prison for 5 years or treatment for as long as it took, and I went to treatment after thinking about it. Like I thought about the shoes. It was a look in the people's eyes at the treatment center, even the technicians, but my counselor and other people there. And I later identified that as love. But I was loved into sobriety, and I reached out to a higher power by praying for the first time in the last 12 years. It was really funny. When I turned my back on God, I started drinking, became an alcoholic, and when I reached out for help, I got sober. It's amazing, these coincidences. It is searching and fearless moral inventory. And I liked it when she read that because she went up ourselves. And I am thoroughly convinced that one of the reasons people come into our lives is to be mirrors. Well, and not always to show us what we're doing wrong. I mean, that's the first place we jump with it. But sometimes they come to show us what our gifts are and what our strong points are and who we can become. And so it's good to go heads up. You know, we can be just so hard on ourselves. It's like, but people stop doing it to us, and so we just pick up right where they left off. And we just keep torturing ourselves. And now we've got cell phones, so we can obsess, you know. It's like we've become therapeutically correct. You know, people occur, you know, they thought for a while this whole thing was a fad and it would go away, codependency recovery. It really did. That was just around for a little while. Yeah, right. But life does move in cycles. And seeing you all here, it's very obvious, and you could feel it coming. You could feel it in the air that we're going through a cycle where people are putting putting a lid on the pills. Because there's medications out now. Is that something that I just need to live with, or do I need to wait it up? Wow. I can't compete with that. It's bigger than I am. gentle with ourselves when we do our inventory, but we need to do it. We need to sit down with a pen and a piece of paper, and we also need to take a look at these survival behaviors. You know, it's not, this whole problem of codependency is not a one-size-fits-all. We are unique in some ways. Each of our stories differ from the others. Some of us may tend to do this more than another behavior. Another person may tend to do that more than something else. And we have to look inside of ourselves. Of all the steps, for you newcomers who haven't traveled through the tunnel yet, and for you old-timers who have been through the steps, my favorite are 6 and 7. They're my absolute favorites because they tell me that I don't have to do the impossible. I do not have to ever change myself. All I have to do is become ready, become willing. That's all I need to do. And you know what I found that's so magical? If I just move, because a lot of times for the newcomers, we think we have to do these steps perfectly. We don't. Well, all we have to do is do them, you know, just even a little bit, the best that we can. And if we move half an inch towards this program, half an inch toward a step, the whole program will come to and encompass us. And it will work its magic on us in our lives in a way that we can't comprehend. I never dreamt in a million years I would be up here before I got into my first 12-step program on a podium talking. I mean, you wouldn't want me in the room. You know, magic happens in our lives, and there is a yellow brick road. And the only wizard are these 12 steps. But we do need to reach out to them, and we do need to take an action call if there's an action. Some of the steps, all we have to do is think about it. Think the words of it. And we will see change happen in our lives. Some of them call. I know when, in the beginning, I used to run around with a list of amends I needed to make because I found that I got this incredible high after making an amends. And so when I'd wake up feeling blue, I would just make an amend, and then I would get this incredible uplifting. It's scary when we first start doing it, but then it gets better with time. I mean, my controlling ran so deep that, like I said about the dressing, I even dressed to control what other people thought. I mean, that is deeply ingrained controlling. And it makes life so hard. It's so much work, and it takes so much energy. There's a lot of things that these 12 steps do for us, and when it says practice them in all our affairs, it means that it will work on financial problems, I promise you that. These steps will. Try it. They will work on financial problems. They'll work on any problem. The only thing they won't do is shortstop grief, because grief is something that does us, and there's a process that we go through with that. And I would call all of you to be more compassionate with people who are in deep grief, you know, especially when they're new and wrong. If mom died, if they had, I was amazed at how much I missed my mother. I was surprised that I cried when my mother died. I finally found, at the end of her life, what I had wanted all my life, and that was a loving relationship with a woman that gave birth to me. She was there when I took my first breath, and I was there for her when she took her last. And I wasn't there because I had to be. I was there because I wanted to be. And it wasn't done out of duty. It was done out of love. And this was a gift this program gave me. Thank you all very much. May you live a blessed, blessed, blessed.